Side 2, The Diamond Throne, by David Eddings, continuing on page 49. Sparhawk started across the courtyard, then stopped. "Oh, be careful of the horse," he warned. "He bites." The novice looked startled, and then cautiously stepped away from the big ugly roan, though still firmly holding the reins. The horse gave Sparhawk a flat, unfriendly stare. "It's more sporting this way, Farron," Sparhawk explained. He started up the worn steps that led into the centuries-old castle. The inside of the chapter house was cool and dim, and the few members of the order Sparhawk met in those halls wore cowled monk's robes, as was customary inside a secure house, although an occasional steely clink betrayed the fact that beneath their humble garb, the members of this order wore chain mail and were inevitably armed. There were no greetings exchanged, and the cowled brothers of Pandion went resolutely about their duties with bowed heads and shadowed faces. Sparhawk put the flat of his hand out in front of one of the cowled men. Pandions seldom touched each other. "Excuse me, brother," he said. "Do you know if Vanion is still in the South Tower?" "He is," the other knight replied. "Thank you, brother. Peace be with you." "And with you, Sir Knight." Sparhawk went on along the torchlit corridor until he came to a narrow stairway which wound up into the South Tower between walls of massive, unmortared stones. At the top of the stairs there was a heavy door, guarded by two young Pandions. Sparhawk did not recognize either of them. "I need to talk with Vanion," he told them. "The name is Sparhawk." "Can you identify yourself?" one of them asked, trying to make his youthful voice sound gruff. "I just did." It hung there while the two young knights struggled to find a graceful way out of the situation. "Why not just open the door and tell Vanion that I'm here?" Sparhawk suggested. "If he recognizes me, fine. If he doesn't, the two of you can try to throw me back down the stairs." He laid no particular emphasis on the word try. The two looked at each other. Then one of them opened the door and looked inside. "A thousand pardons, my lord Vanion," he apologized. "But there's a Pandion here who calls himself Sparhawk. He says that he wants to talk with you." "Good," a familiar voice replied from inside the room. "I've been expecting him. Send him in." The two knights looked abashed and stepped out of Sparhawk's way. "Thank you, my brothers," Sparhawk murmured to them. "Peace be with you." And then he went on through the door. The room was large, with stone walls, dark green drapes at the narrow windows, and a carpet of muted brown. A fire crackled in the arched fireplace at one end, and there was a candlelit table surrounded by heavy chairs in the center. Two people, a man and a woman, sat at the table. Vanion, the preceptor of the Pandion Knights, had aged somewhat in the past 10 years. His hair and beard were iron gray now. There were a few more lines in his face, but there were no signs of feebleness there. He wore a mail shirt and a silver surcoat. As Sparhawk entered the room, he rose and came around the table. "I was about to send a rescue party to the palace for you," he said, grasping Sparhawk's armored shoulders. "You shouldn't have gone there alone, you know." "Maybe not, but things worked out all right." Sparhawk removed his gauntlets and helmet, laying them on the table. Then he unfastened his sword from its studs and laid it beside them. "It's good to see you again, Vanion," he said, taking the older man's hand in his. Vanion had always been a stern teacher, tolerating no shortcomings in the young knights he had trained to take their places in Pandion ranks. Although Sparhawk had come close to hating the man during his novitiate, he now regarded the blunt-spoken preceptor as one of his closest friends, and their handclasp was warm, even affectionate. Then the big knight turned to the woman. She was small and had that peculiar neat perfection one sometimes sees in small people. Her hair was as black as night, though her eyes were a deep blue. Her features were obviously not Eline, but had that strangely foreign cast that marked her as hysteric. She wore a soft white robe, and there was a large book on the table in front of her. "Sifrania," he greeted her warmly. "You're looking well." He took both of her hands in his and kissed her palms in the ritual styric gesture of greeting. "You have been long away, Sir Sparhawk," she replied. Her voice was soft and musical and had an odd lilting quality to it. "And will you bless me, little mother?" he asked, a smile touching his battered face. He knelt before her. The form of address was styric, reflecting that intimate personal connection between teacher and pupil which has existed since the dawn of time. "Gladly." She lightly touched her hands to his face and spoke a ritual benediction in the Styric tongue. "Thank you," he said simply. Then she did something she rarely did. With her hands still holding his face, she leaned forward and lightly kissed him. "Welcome home, dear one," she murmured.
"It's good to be back," he replied. "I've missed you."
"Even though I scolded you when you were a boy?" she asked with a gentle smile.
"Scoldings don't hurt that much," he laughed. "I even missed those for some reason."
"I think that perhaps we did well with this one, Vanion," she said to the preceptor. "Between us, we've made a good pandion."
"One of the best," Vanion agreed. "I think Sparhawk's what they had in mind when they formed the order."
Sophrenia's position among the pandion knights was a peculiar one. She had appeared at the gates of the Order's mother house at Deimos upon the death of the Styric tutor who had been instructing the novices in what the Styrics referred to as the secrets. She had neither been selected nor summoned, but had simply appeared and taken up her predecessor's duties. Generally, Eline's despised and feared Styrics. They were a strange, alien people who lived in small, rude clusters of houses deep in the forests and mountains. They worshipped strange gods and practiced magic. Wild stories about hideous rites involving the use of Eline blood and flesh had circulated among the more gullible in Eline society for centuries, and periodically mobs of drunken peasants would descend on unsuspecting Styric villages, bent on massacre. The church vigorously denounced such atrocities. The church knights, who had come to know and respect their alien tutors, went perhaps a step further than the church, letting it be generally known that unprovoked attacks on Styric settlements would result in swift and savage retaliation. Despite such organized protection, however, any Styric who entered an Eline village or town could expect taunts and abuse, and, not infrequently, showers of stones and offal. Thus, Sophrenia's appearance at Deimos had not been without personal risk. Her motives for coming had been unclear, but over the years she had served faithfully. To a man, the Pandions had come to love and respect her. Even Vanion, the preceptor of the order, frequently sought her counsel. Sparhawk looked at the volume lying on the table before her. "A book, Sophrenia?" he said in mock amazement. "Has Vanion finally persuaded you to learn how to read?" "You know my beliefs about that practice, Sparhawk," she replied. "I was merely looking at the pictures." She pointed at the brilliant illuminations on the page. "I was ever fond of bright colors."
Sparhawk drew up a chair and sat, his armor creaking.
"You saw Elana?" Vanion asked, resuming his seat across the table.
"Yes."
Sparhawk looked at Sophrenia.
"How did you do that?" he asked her. "Seal her up like that, I mean."
"It's a bit complex." Then she stopped and gave him a penetrating look. "Perhaps you're ready at that," she murmured. She rose to her feet. "Come over here, Sparhawk," she said, moving toward the fireplace. Puzzled, he rose and followed her.
"Look into the flames, dear one," she said softly,
using that odd Styric form of address she had used when he was her pupil. Compelled by her voice, he stared at the fire. Faintly, he heard her whispering in Styric, and then she passed her hand slowly across the flames. Unthinking, he sank to his knees and stared into the fireplace. Something was moving in the fire. Sparhawk leaned forward and stared hard at the little bluish curls of flame dancing along the edge of a charred oak log. The blue color expanded, growing larger and larger, and within that nimbus of coruscating blue, he seemed to see a group of figures that wavered as the flame flickered. The image grew stronger, and he realized that he was looking at the semblance of the throne room in the palace many miles away. 12 armored pandions were crossing the flagstone floor, bearing the slight figure of a young girl. She was borne not upon a litter, but upon the flat sides of a dozen gleaming sword blades held rock steady by the 12 black-armored and visored men. They stopped before the throne, and Sophrenia's white-robed figure stepped out of the shadows. She raised one hand, seeming to say something, though all Sparhawk could hear was the crackling flames. With a dreadful jerking motion, the young girl sat up. It was Elana. Her face was distorted, and her eyes wide and vacant. Without thinking, Sparhawk reached toward her, thrusting his hand directly into the flames.
"No," Sophrenia said sharply, pulling his hand back. "You may watch only."
The image of Elana, trembling uncontrollably, jerked to its feet, following, it seemed, the unspoken commands of the small woman in the white robe. Imperiously, Sophrenia pointed at the throne, and Elana stumbled, even staggered, up the steps of the dais to assume her rightful place. Sparhawk wept.
He tried once again to reach out to his queen, but Sophronia held him back with a gentle touch that was strangely like an iron chain.
"Continue to watch, dear one," she told him. The 12 knights then formed a circle around the enthroned queen and the white-robed woman standing at her side. Reverently they extended their swords so that the two women on the dais were ringed in steel.
Sophronia raised her arms and spoke. Sparhawk could clearly see the strain on her face as she uttered the words of an incantation he could not even begin to imagine. The point of each of the 12 swords began to glow and grew brighter and brighter, bathing the dais in intense silvery white light. The light from those sword tips seemed to coalesce around Elana and her throne. Then Sophronia spoke a single word, bringing her arm down as she did so in a peculiar cutting motion. In an instant, the light around Elana solidified, and she became as she had been when Sparhawk had seen her in the throne room that morning. The image of Sophronia, however, wilted and collapsed on the dais beside the crystal-encased throne. The tears were streaming openly down Sparhawk's face, and Sophronia gently enfolded his head in her arms, holding him to her.
"It is not easy, Sparhawk," she comforted him. "To look thus into the fire opens the heart, and allows what we really are to emerge. You are gentler far than you would have us believe."
He wiped at his eyes with the back of his hand. "How long will the crystal sustain her?" he asked.
"For so long as the 13 of us who were there continue to live," Sophronia replied. "A year at most, as Yuelin's measure time."
He stared at her.
"It is our life force that keeps her heart alive. As the seasons turn, we will one by one drop away, and one of us who was there will then have to assume the burden of the fallen. Eventually, when we have each and every one given all we can, your queen will die."
"No," he said fiercely. He looked at Vanion. "Were you there too?"
Vanion nodded.
"Who else?" "It wouldn't serve any purpose for you to know that, Sparhawk. We all went willingly, and we knew what was involved."
"Who's going to take up the burden you mentioned?" Sparhawk asked Sophronia.
"I will."
"We are still arguing that point," Vanion disagreed. "Any one of us who was there can do it, actually."
"Not unless we modify the spell, Vanion," she told him just a bit smugly.
"We'll see," he said.
"But what good does it do?" Sparhawk demanded. "All you've done is to give her a year more of life at a dreadful cost, and she doesn't even know.
If we can isolate the cause of her illness and find a cure, the spell can be reversed," Sophronia replied. "We have suspended her life to give us time."
"Are we making any progress?"
"I've got every physician in Alania working on it," Vanion said, "and I've summoned others from various parts of Eosia. Sophronia's looking into the possibility that the illness may not be of natural origin. We're encountering some resistance, though. The court physicians refuse to cooperate."
"I'll go back to the palace, then," Sparhawk said bleakly. "Perhaps I can persuade them to be more helpful."
"We thought of that already, but Anius has them all closely guarded."
"What is Anius up to?" Sparhawk burst out angrily. "All we want to do is restore Elana. Why is he putting all these stumbling blocks in our path? Does he want the throne for himself?"
"I think he has his eyes on a bigger throne," Vanion said. "The arch-prelate Clavonus is old and in poor health. I wouldn't be at all surprised if Anius believes that the mitre of the arch-prelacy might fit him."
"Anius? Arch-prelate?"
"Vanion, that's an absurdity."
"Life is filled with absurdities, Sparhawk. The militant orders are all opposed to him, of course, and our opinion carries a great deal of weight with the church hierocracy. But Anius has his hands in the treasury of Alania up to the elbows, and he's very free with his bribes. Elana would have been able to cut off his access to that money, but she fell ill. That may have something to do with his lack of enthusiasm about her recovery."
"And he wants to put Orisa's bastard on the throne to replace her?" Sparhawk was growing angrier by the minute. "Vanion, I've just seen Lycaeus. He's weaker and stupider than King Aldreus was. Besides, he's illegitimate."
Vanion spread his hands.
"A vote of the royal council could legitimize him, and Anius controls the council."
"Not all of it, he doesn't," Sparhawk grated. "Technically, I'm also a member of the council, and I think I might just want to sway a few votes if that ever came up.
A public duel or two might change the minds of the council.
You're rash, Sparhawk, Sophronia told him.
No, I'm angry. I feel a powerful urge to hurt some people.
Fenion sighed. We can't make any decisions just yet, he said.
Then he shook his head and turned to another matter. What's really going on in Rendor? He asked. Vorin's reports were all rather carefully worded in the event they fell into unfriendly hands.
Sparhawk rose and went to one of the embrasured windows with his black cape swirling about his ankles.
The sky was still covered with dirty-looking cloud, and the city of Cimera seemed to crouch beneath that scud as if clenched to endure yet another winter.
It's hot there, he mused, almost as if to himself, and dry and dusty.
The sun reflects back from the walls and pierces the eye. At first light, before the sun rises and the sky is like molten silver, veiled women in black robes with clay vessels on their shoulders pass in silence through the streets, on their way to the wells.
I've misjudged you, Sparhawk, Sophronia said in her melodic voice. You have the soul of a poet.
Not really, Sophronia. It's just that you need to get the feel of Rendor to understand what's happening there. The sun is like the blows of a hammer on the top of your head, and the air is so hot and dry that it leaves no time for thought. Rendors seek simplistic answers. The sun doesn't give them time for pondering.
That might explain what happened to Ashand in the first place. A simple shepherd with his brains half-baked out isn't the logical receptacle for any kind of profound epiphany. It's the aggravation of the sun, I think, that gave the Ashandist heresy its impetus in the first place. Those poor fools would have accepted any idea, no matter how absurd, just for the chance to move around, and perhaps find some shade.
That's a novel explanation for a movement that plunged all of Eosia into 3 centuries of warfare, Vanion observed.
You have to experience it, Sparhawk told him, returning to his seat.
Anyway, one of those sun-baked enthusiasts arose at Dabur about 20 years ago.
Arasham, Vanion surmised. We've heard of him.
That's what he calls himself, Sparhawk replied. He was probably born with a different name, though. Religious leaders tend to change their names fairly often to fit the prejudices of their followers. From what I understand, Arasham is an unlettered, unwashed fanatic with only a tenuous grip on reality. He's about 80 or so, and he sees things and hears voices. His followers have less intelligence than their sheep. They'd gladly attack the kingdoms of the north if they could only figure out which way north is. That's a matter of serious debate in Rendor. I've seen a few of them. These heretics that send the members of the hierocracy in Kyrolos trembling to their beds every night are little more than howling desert dervishes, poorly armed and with no military training. Frankly, Vanion, I'd worry more about the next winter storm than any kind of resurgence of the Ashandist heresy in Rendor.
That's blunt enough.
I've just wasted 10 years of my life on a non-existent danger. I'm sure you'll forgive a certain amount of discontent about the whole thing.
Patience will come to you, Sparhawk, Sophronia smiled, once you have reached maturity.
I thought that I already had.
Not by half.
He grinned at her then.
Just how old are you, Sophronia? He asked.
Her look was filled with resignation.
What is it about you Pandions that makes you all ask that same question? You know I'm not going to answer you. Can't you just accept the fact that I'm older than you are and let it go at that?
You're also older than I am, Vanion added. You were my teacher when I was no older than those boys who guard my door.
And do I look so very, very old?
My dear Sophronia, you're as young as spring and as wise as winter. You've ruined us all, you know. After we've known you, the fairest of maidens have no charm for us.
Isn't he nice? She smiled at Sparhawk. Surely no other man alive has so beguiling a tongue.
Try him sometime when you've just missed a pass with the lance, Sparhawk replied sourly. He shifted his shoulders under the weight of his armor.
What else is afoot? I've been gone a long time and I'm hungry for news.
Oath is mobilizing, Vanion told him. The word that's coming out of Zamok is that he's looking eastward toward Darasia and the Tamil Empire. But I've got a few doubts about that.
And I have more than a few, Sophronia agreed. The kingdoms of the west are suddenly awash with Styric vagabonds. They camp at crossroads and hawk the rude goods of Styricum, but no local Styric band acknowledges them as members.
For some reason, the Emperor Otha and his cruel master have inundated us with watchers. Azash has driven the Zamoks to attack the West before. Something lies hidden here that he desperately wants, and he's not going to find it in Darasia.
There have been Zamok mobilizations before, Sparhawk said, leaning back. Nothing ever came of it.
I think that this time might be a bit more serious, Vanion disagreed. When he gathered his forces before, it was always on the border. As soon as the four militant orders moved into Lamorkhan to face him, he disbanded his armies. He was testing us, nothing more. This time, though, he's massing his troops back behind the mountains, out of sight, so to speak.
Let him come, Sparhawk said bleakly. We stopped him 500 years ago, and we can do it again if we have to.
Vanion shook his head. We don't want a repetition of what happened after the battle at Lake Rondera. A century of famine, pestilence, and complete social collapse? No, my friend, that we don't want.
If we can avoid it, Sophrenia added.
I am Styric, and I know even better than you, Alines, just how totally evil the Elder God Azash is. If he comes west again, he must be stopped, no matter what the cost.
That's what the Church Knights are here for, Vanion said. Right now, about all we can do is keep our eyes on Otha.
I just remembered something, Sparhawk said.
When I was riding into town last night, I saw Kroger.
Here in Simara? Vanion asked, sounding surprised. Do you think Martell could be with him?
Probably not. Kroger's usually Martell's errand boy. Ardis is the one who has to be kept on a short chain.
He squinted his eyes.
How much did you hear about the incident in Cypria? He asked them.
We heard that Martell attacked you, Vanion replied. That's about all.
There was a bit more to it than that, Sparhawk told him. When Aldreas sent me to Cypria, I was supposed to report to the Alanian consul there, a diplomat who just happens to be the cousin of the primate Aeneas. Late one night he summoned me. I was on my way to his house when Martell, Ardis, and Kroger, along with a fair number of local cutthroats, came charging out of a side street. There's no way that they could have known that I'd be passing that way unless someone had told them. Put that together with the fact that Kroger's back in Simara where there's a price on his head, and you start to come up with some interesting conclusions.
You think that Martell is working for Aeneas?
It's a possibility, wouldn't you say?
Aeneas wasn't very happy about the way my father forced Aldreas to give up the notion of marrying his own sister, and it's entirely possible that he felt that he'd have a freer hand here in Alania if the family of Sparhawk became extinct in a back alley in Cypria. Of course, Martell has his own reasons for disliking me.
I really think you made a mistake, Vanion. You could have saved us all a lot of trouble if you hadn't ordered me to withdraw my challenge.
Vanion shook his head.
No, Sparhawk, he said. Martell had been a brother in our order, and I didn't want you two trying to kill each other. Besides, I couldn't be entirely sure who'd win. Martell is very dangerous.
So am I.
I'm not taking any unnecessary chances with you, Sparhawk. You're too valuable.
Well, it's too late to worry about it now.
What are your plans?
I'm supposed to stay here in the chapter house.
But I think I'll drift around the city a bit and see if I can run across Kroger again. If I can connect him with anybody who's working for Aeneas, I'll be able to answer a few burning questions.
Perhaps you should wait a bit, Sophrenia advised.
Colton's on his way back from Lamorkhand.
Colton? I haven't seen him in years.
She's right, Sparhawk, Vanion agreed. Colton's a good man in tight quarters, and the streets of Simara can be just as dangerous as the alleys of Cypria.
When's he likely to arrive?
Vanion shrugged.
Soon, I think. It could even be today.
I'll wait until he gets here.
An idea came to Sparhawk then. He smiled at his teacher and rose to his feet.
What are you doing, Sparhawk? She asked him suspiciously.
Oh, nothing, he replied.
He began to speak in Styric, weaving his fingers in the air in front of him as he did so. When he had built the spell, he released it and held out his hand. There came a humming vibration, followed by a dimming of the candles and a lowering of the flames in the fireplace. When the light came up again, he was holding a bouquet of violets.
For you, little mother, he said, bowing slightly and offering the flowers to her. Because I love you.
Why, thank you, Sparhawk.
She smiled, taking them. You were always the most thoughtful of my pupils. You mispronounced Starava, though, she added critically. You came very close to filling your hand with snakes.
I'll practice, he promised.
Do.
There was a respectful knock at the door.
Yes,
Vanian called.
The door opened, and one of the young knights stepped inside.
There's a messenger from the palace outside, Lord Vanion. He says that he has been commanded to speak with Sir Sparhawk.
Now what do they want? Sparhawk muttered.
You'd better send him in, Vanion told the young knight.
At once, my lord.
The knight bowed slightly and went out again. The messenger had a familiar face. His blonde hair was still elegantly curled, his saffron-colored doublet, lavender hose, maroon shoes, and apple-green cloak still clashed horribly. The young fop's face, however, sported an entirely new embellishment. The very tip of his pointed nose was adorned with a large and extremely painful-looking boil. He was trying, without much success, to conceal the excrescence with a lace-trimmed handkerchief. He bowed elegantly to Vanion.
"My Lord Preceptor," he said, "the Prince Regent sends his compliments."
"And please convey mine back to him," Vanion replied.
"Be assured that I shall, my lord."
The elegant fellow then turned to Sparhawk.
"My message is for you, Sir Knight," he declared.
"Say on, then," Sparhawk answered with exaggerated formality. "My ears hunger for your message."
The fop ignored that. He removed a sheet of parchment from inside his doublet and read grandly from it.
"By royal decree, you are commanded by His Highness to journey straightway to the motherhouse of the Pandion Knights at Deimos, there to devote yourself to your religious duties until such time as he sees fit to summon you once again to the palace."
"I see," Sparhawk replied.
"Do you understand the message, Sir Sparhawk?"
the fop asked, handing over the parchment.
Sparhawk did not bother to read the document.
"It was quite clear. You have completed your mission in a fashion which does you credit."
Sparhawk peered at the perfumed young fellow. "If you don't mind some advice, neighbor, you ought to have that boil looked at by a surgeon. If it isn't lanced soon, it's going to keep growing to the point where you won't be able to see around it."
The fop winced at the word lanced.
"Do you really think so, Sir Sparhawk?" he asked plaintively, lowering his handkerchief. "Wouldn't a poultice, perhaps..."
Sparhawk shook his head.
"No, neighbor," he said with false sympathy. "I can almost guarantee you that a poultice won't work. Be brave, my man. Lancing is the only solution."
The courtier's face grew melancholy. He bowed and left the room.
"Did you do that to him, Sparhawk?" Sophronia asked suspiciously.
"Me?"
He gave her a look of wide-eyed innocence.
"Somebody did. That eruption is not natural."
"My, my," he said. "Imagine that."
"Well," Vanion said, "are you going to obey the bastard's orders?"
"Of course not," Sparhawk snorted. "I've got too many things to do here in Simera."
"You'll make him very angry."
"So?"
Chapter 4 The sky had turned threatening again when Sparhawk emerged from the chapter house and clanked down the stairs into the courtyard. The novice came from the stable door leading Farron, and Sparhawk looked thoughtfully at him. He was perhaps 18 and quite tall. He had knobby wrists that stuck out of an earth-colored tunic that was too small for him.
"What's your name, young man?" Sparhawk asked him.
"Beirut, my lord."
"What are your duties here?"
"I haven't been assigned anything specific as yet, my lord. I just try to make myself useful."
"Good.
Turn around."
"My lord, I want to measure you."
Beirut looked puzzled, but he did as he was told. Sparhawk measured him across the shoulders with his hands. Although he looked bony, Beirut was actually a husky youth.
"You'll do fine," Sparhawk told him.
Beirut turned, his face baffled.
"You're going to be making a trip," Sparhawk told him. "Gather up what you'll need while I go get the man who's going to go with you."
"Yes, my lord,"
Beirut replied, bowing respectfully. Sparhawk took hold of the saddle bow and hauled himself up onto Farron's back. Beirut handed him the reins, and Sparhawk nudged the big roan into a walk. They crossed the courtyard, and Sparhawk responded to the salutes of the knights at the gate. Then he rode on across the drawbridge and through the east gate of the city. The streets of Simera were busy now. Workmen carrying large bundles wrapped in muddy-colored burlap
grunted their way through the narrow lanes, and merchants dressed in conventional blue stood in the doorways of their shops with their brightly colored wares piled around them. An occasional wagon clattered along the cobblestones. Near the intersection of two narrow streets, a squad of church soldiers in their scarlet livery marched with a certain arrogant precision. Sparhawk did not give way to them, but instead bore down on them at a steady trot. Grudgingly, they separated and stood aside as he passed. "Thank you, neighbors," Sparhawk said pleasantly. They did not answer him. He reined Farron in. "I said, thank you, neighbors." "You're welcome," one of them replied sullenly. Sparhawk waited. "My lord," the soldier added grudgingly. "Much better, friend." Sparhawk rode on. The gate to the inn was closed, and Sparhawk leaned over and banged on its timbers with his gauntleted fist. The porter who swung it open for him was not the same knight who had admitted him the evening before. Sparhawk swung down from Farron's back and handed him the reins. "Will you be needing him again, my lord?" the knight asked. "Yes, I'll be going right back out. Would you saddle my squire's horse, sir knight?" "Of course, my lord." "I appreciate that." Sparhawk laid one hand on Farron's neck. "Behave yourself," he said. Farron looked away, his expression lofty. Sparhawk clinked up the stairs and rapped on the door of the room at the top. Curic opened the door for him. "Well, how did it go?" "Not bad." "You came out alive, anyway. Did you see the queen?"
"Yes."
"That's surprising."
"I sort of insisted."
"Do you want to get your things together? You're going back to Deimos."
"You didn't say we, Sparhawk."
"I'm staying here."
"I suppose there are good reasons?"
"Lycaeus has ordered me back to the Mother House. I more or less plan to ignore him, but I want to be able to move around Cimera without being followed. There's a young novice at the chapter house who's about my size. We'll put him in my armor and mount him on Farron. Then the two of you can ride to Deimos with a grand show of obedience. As long as he keeps his visor down, the primate's spies will think I'm obeying orders."
"It's workable, I suppose.
I don't like the idea of leaving you here alone, though."
"I won't be alone. Colton's coming in either today or tomorrow."
"That's a little better. Colton's steady."
Curic frowned.
"I thought that he'd been exiled to Lamarkand. Who ordered him back?"
"Vanion didn't say, but you know Colton. Maybe he just got bored with Lamarkand and took independent action."
"How long do you want me to stay at Deimos?" Curic asked as he began to gather up his things.
"A month or so at least. The road's likely to be watched. I'll get word to you."
"Do you need any money?"
"I always need money, Sparhawk."
"There's some in the pocket of that tunic." Sparhawk pointed at his travel clothes draped across the back of a chair.
"Take what you need."
Curic grinned at him.
"Leave me a little, though."
"Of course, my lord," Curic said with a mocking bow. "Do you want me to pack up your things?"
"No. I'll be coming back here when Colton arrives. It's a little hard to get in and out of the chapter house without being seen. Is the back door to that tavern still open?"
"It was yesterday. I drop in there from time to time."
"I thought you might."
"A man needs a few vices, Sparhawk. It gives him something to repent when he goes to chapel. If Asladi hears that you've been drinking, she'll set fire to your beard.
Then we'll just have to make sure that she doesn't hear about it, won't we, my lord?"
"Why do I always get mixed up in your domestic affairs?"
"It keeps your feet planted in reality. Get your own wife, Sparhawk, then other women won't feel obliged to take special note of you. A married man is safe. A bachelor is a constant challenge to any woman alive."
About half an hour later, Sparhawk and his squire went down the stairs into the courtyard, mounted their horses, and rode out through the gate. They clattered along the cobblestone streets toward the east gate of the city.
"We're being watched, you know," Curic said quietly.
"I certainly hope so," Sparhawk replied. "I'd hate to have to ride around in circles until we attract somebody's attention." They went through the ritual again at the drawbridge of the chapter house and then rode on into the courtyard. Beirut was waiting for them.
"This is Curic," Sparhawk told him as he dismounted. "The two of you will be going to Deimos."
"Curic, the young man's name is Beirut." The squire looked the acolyte up and down.
"He's the right size," he noted.
I might have to shorten a few straps, but your armor should come close to fitting him.
I thought so myself.
Another novice came out and took their reins. Come along then, you two, Sparhawk said. Let's go tell Vanion what we're going to do, and then we'll put my armor on our masquerader here.
Bayret looked startled.
You're being promoted, Bayret,
Curic told him.
You see how quickly one can move up in the Pandions? Yesterday a novice, today Queen's champion.
I'll explain it to you when we see Vanion, Sparhawk told Bayret. It's not so interesting a story that I want to go over it more than once. It was mid-afternoon when the three of them emerged from the chapter house door again. Bayret walked awkwardly in the unaccustomed armor, and Sparhawk was dressed in a plain tunic and hose.
I think it's going to rain, Curic said, squinting at the sky.
You won't melt, Sparhawk told him.
I'm not worried about that, the squire replied. It's just that I'll have to scour the rust off your armor again.
Life is hard.
Curic grunted, and then the two of them boosted Bayret up into Farron's saddle.
You're going to take this young man to Deimos, Sparhawk told his horse. Try to behave as if it were me on your back.
Farron gave him an inquiring look.
It would take much too long to explain. It's entirely up to you, Farron, but he's wearing my armor, so if you try to bite him, you'll probably break your teeth.
Sparhawk turned to his squire.
Say hello to Asladi and the boys for me, he said.
Right,
Curic nodded. Then he swung up into his saddle.
Don't make too big a show when you leave, Sparhawk added, but make sure that you're seen, and make sure that Bayret keeps his visor down.
I know what I'm doing, Sparhawk.
Come along then, my lord, Curic said to Bayret.
My lord?
You might as well get used to it, Bayret.
Curic pulled his horse around.
I'll see you, Sparhawk.
Then the two of them rode out of the courtyard toward the drawbridge.
The rest of the day passed quietly. Sparhawk sat in the cell which Vanion had assigned to him, reading a musty old book. At sundown he joined the other brothers in the refectory for the simple evening meal, then marched in quiet procession with them to chapel. Sparhawk's religious convictions were not profound, but there was again that sense of renewal involved in the return to the practices of his novitiate. Vanion conducted the services that evening and spoke at some length on the virtue of humility. In keeping with his long-standing practice, Sparhawk fell into a doze about halfway through the sermon. He was awakened at the end of the sermon by the voice of an angel. A young knight with hair the color of butter and a neck like a marble column lifted his clear tenor voice in a hymn of praise. His face shone, and his eyes were filled with adoration.
Was I really all that boring? Vanion murmured, falling in beside Sparhawk as they left the chapel.
Probably not, Sparhawk replied, but I'm not really in any position to judge.
Did you do the one about the simple daisy being as beautiful in the eyes of God as the rose?
You've heard it before.
Frequently.
The old ones are the best.
Who's your tenor?
Sir Parasim. He just won his spurs.
I don't want to alarm you, Vanion, but he's too good for this world.
I know.
God will probably call him home very soon.
That's God's business, isn't it, Sparhawk?
Do me a favor, Vanion. Don't put me in a situation where I'm the one who lets him get killed.
That's also God's business.
Sleep well, Sparhawk.
You too, Vanion.
It was probably about midnight when the door to Sparhawk's cell banged open. He rolled quickly out of his narrow cot and came to his feet with his sword in his hand.
Don't do that, the big blond-haired man in the doorway said in disgust.
He was holding a candle in one hand and a wineskin in the other.
Hello, Carlton, Sparhawk greeted his boyhood friend. When did you get in?
About a half hour ago. I thought I was going to have to scale the walls there for a while. He looked disgusted.
It's peacetime. Why do they raise the drawbridge every night?
Probably out of habit.
Are you going to put that down? Carlton asked, pointing at the sword in Sparhawk's hand. Or am I going to have to drink this whole thing by myself?
Sorry, Sparhawk said. He leaned his plain sword against the wall.
Carlton set his candle on the small table in the corner, tossed the wineskin onto Sparhawk's bed, and then caught his friend in a huge bear hug.
It's good to see you, he declared.
And you too, Sparhawk replied.
Have a seat. He pointed at the stool by the table and sat down on the edge of his cot. How was Lammerkand? Calton made an indelicate sound. Cold, damp, and nervous, he replied. Lamerks are not my favorite people in the world. How was Rendor? Sparhawk shrugged. Hot, dry, and probably just as nervous as Lammerkand. I heard a rumor that you ran into Martell down there. Did you give him a nice funeral? He got away. You're slipping, Sparhawk. Calton unfastened the collar of his cloak. A great mat of curly blonde hair protruded out of the neck of his mail coat. Are you going to sit on that wineskin all night? He asked pointedly. Sparhawk grunted, unstoppered the skin, and lifted it to his lips. Not bad, he said. Where did you get it? He handed the skin to his friend. I picked it up in a wayside tavern about sundown, he replied. I remembered that all there is to drink in Pandion chapter houses is water, or tea if Sophrenia happens to be around. Stupid custom. We are a religious order, Calton. There are a half dozen patriarchs in Kyrillos who get drunk as lords every night. Calton lifted the wineskin and took a long drink. Then he shook the skin. I should have picked up two, he observed. Oh, by the way, Curic was in the tavern with some young puppy wearing your armor. I should have guessed that, Sparhawk said wryly. Anyway, Curic told me that you were here. I was going to spend the night there, but when I heard that you'd come back from Rendor, I rode on the rest of the way. I'm touched. Calton laughed and handed back the wineskin. Were Curic and the novice staying out of sight? Sparhawk asked. Calton nodded. They were in one of the back rooms, and the young fellow was keeping his visor down. Have you ever seen anybody try to drink through his visor? Funniest thing I ever saw. There were a couple of local whores there, too. Your young Pandion might be getting an education along about now. He's due, Sparhawk observed. I wonder if he'll try to do that with his visor down as well. Those girls are usually adaptable. Calton laughed. Anyhow, Curic told me about the situation here. Do you really believe you can sneak around Simra without being recognized? I was thinking along the lines of a disguise of some sort. Better come up with a false nose, Calton advised. That broken beak of yours makes you fairly easy to pick out of a crowd. You should know, Sparhawk said. You're the one who broke it. We were only playing, Calton said, sounding a bit defensive. I've gotten used to it. We'll talk with Sophrenia in the morning. She should be able to come up with something in the way of disguises. I'd heard that she was here. How is she? The same. Sophrenia never changes. Truly. Calton took another drink from the wineskin and wiped his mouth with the back of his hand. You know, I think I was always a big disappointment to her. No matter how hard she tried to teach me the secrets, I just couldn't master the Styric language. Every time I tried to say Ogaragekasek, I almost dislocated my jaw. Okaragukasek, Sparhawk corrected him. However you say it, I'll just stick to my sword and let others play with magic. He leaned forward on his stool. They say that the Ashandists are on the rise again in Rendor. Is there any truth to that? It's no particular danger. Sparhawk shrugged, lounging back on his cot. They howl and spin around in circles out in the desert and recite slogans to each other. That's about as far as it goes. Is anything very interesting going on in Lammerkand? Calton snorted. All the barons there are involved in private wars with each other, he reported. The whole kingdom reeks with the lust for revenge. Would you believe that there's actually a war going on over a bee sting? An earl got stung and declared war on the baron whose peasants owned the hive. They've been fighting each other for 10 years now. That's Lammerkand for you. Anything else happening? The whole countryside east of Moterra is crawling with Zamox. Sparhawk sat up quickly. Vanion did say that Otha was mobilizing. Otha mobilizes every 10 years. Calton handed his friend the wineskin. I think he does it just to keep his people from getting restless. Are the Zamox doing anything significant in Lammerkand? Not that I was able to tell. They're asking a lot of questions, mostly about old folklore. You can find two or three of them in almost every village. They question old women and buy drinks for the loafers in the village taverns. Peculiar, Sparhawk murmured.
That's a fairly accurate description of just about anybody from Zamok, Colton said. Sanity has never been particularly prized there. He stood up. I'll go find a cot someplace, he said. I can drag it in here and we can talk old times until we both fall asleep. All right. Colton grinned. Like the time your father caught us in that plum tree. Sparhawk winced. I've been trying to forget about that for almost 30 years now. Your father did have a very firm hand, as I recall. I lost track of most of the rest of that day, and the plums gave me a bellyache besides. I'll be right back. He turned and went out the door of Sparhawk's cell. It was good to have Colton back. The two of them had grown up together in the house of Sparhawk's parents at Deimos, after Colton's family had been killed, and before the pair of boys had entered their novitiate training at the Pandion Mother House. In many ways, they were closer than brothers. To be sure, Colton had some rough edges to him, but their close friendship was one of the things Sparhawk valued more than anything else. After a short time, the big blonde man returned, dragging a cot behind him, and then the two of them lay in the dim candlelight reminiscing until quite late. All in all, it was a very good night. Early the following morning, they rose and dressed themselves, covering their male coats with the hooded robes Pandions wore when they were inside their chapter houses. They rather carefully avoided the morning procession to chapel, and went in search of the woman who had trained whole generations of Pandion knights in the intricacies of what were called the secrets. They found her seated with her morning tea before the fire high up in the south tower. Good morning, little mother, Sparhawk greeted her from the doorway. Do you mind if we join you?
Not at all, Sir Knights.
Colton went to her, knelt, and kissed both her palms. Will you bless me, little mother? He asked her. She smiled and put one hand on each side of his face. Then she spoke her benediction in Styric. That always makes me feel better for some reason, he said, rising to his feet again, even though I don't understand all the words. She looked at them critically. I see that you chose not to attend chapel this morning. God won't miss us all that much, Colton shrugged. Besides, I could recite all of Vanion's sermons from memory. What other mischief are you two planning for today? She asked.
Mischief, Sophrenia? Colton asked innocently.
Sparhawk laughed. Actually, we weren't even contemplating any mischief. We just have a fairly simple errand in mind.
Out in the city?
He nodded. The only problem is that we're both fairly well known here in Simura. We thought you might be able to help us with some disguises. She looked at them, her expression cool.
I'm getting a strong sense of subterfuge in all this. Just exactly what is this errand of yours?
We thought we'd look up an old friend, Sparhawk replied. A fellow named Kroger. He has some information he might want to share with us.
Information?
He knows where Martell is.
Kroger won't tell you that.
Colton cracked his big knuckles, the sound unpleasantly calling to mind the sharp noise of breaking bones. Would you care to phrase that in the form of a wager, Sophrenia? He asked.
Won't you two ever grow up? You're a pair of eternal children.
That's why you love us so much, isn't it, little mother? Colton grinned. What sort of disguise would you recommend? Sparhawk asked her. She pursed her lips and looked at them.
A courtier and his squire, I think.
No one could ever mistake me for a courtier, he objected.
I was thinking of it the other way around. I can make you look almost like a good honest squire, and once we dress Colton in a satin doublet and curl that long blonde hair of his, he can pass for a courtier.
I do look good in satin, Colton murmured modestly. Why not just a couple of common workmen? Sparhawk asked. She shook her head.
Common workmen cringe and fawn when they encounter a nobleman. Could either of you manage a cringe?
She's got a point, Colton said.
Besides, workmen don't carry swords, and I don't imagine that either of you would care to go into Simura unarmed.
She thinks of everything, doesn't she? Sparhawk observed.
All right, she said. Let's see what we can do.
Several acolytes were sent scurrying to various places in the chapter house for a number of articles. Sophrenia considered each one of them, selecting some and discarding others. What emerged after about an hour were two men who only faintly resembled the pair of Pandions who had first entered the room.
Sparhawk now wore a plain livery, not unlike Keurig's, and he carried a short sword. A fierce black beard was glued to his face, and a purple scar ran across his broken nose and up under a black patch that covered his left eye. "This thing itches," he complained, reaching up to scratch at the false beard. "Keep your fingers off of it until the glue dries," she told him, lightly slapping his knuckles, "and put on a glove to cover that ring." "Do you actually expect me to carry this toy?" Carlton demanded, flourishing a light rapier. "I want a sword, not a knitting needle."
"Courtiers don't carry broadswords, Carlton," she reminded him.
She looked at him critically. His doublet was bright blue, gored and inset with red satin. His hose matched the goring, and he wore soft half-boots, since no pair of the pointed shoes currently in fashion could be found to fit his huge feet. His cape was of pale pink, and his freshly curled blonde hair spilled down over the collar. He also wore a broad-brimmed hat, adorned with a white plume.
"You look beautiful, Carlton," she complimented him. "I think you might pass, once I rouge your cheeks."
"Absolutely not!" He backed away from her. "Carlton," she said quite firmly, "sit down." She pointed at a chair and reached for a rouge pot. "Do I have to?"
"Yes. Now sit."
Carlton looked at Sparhawk. "If you laugh, we're going to fight, so don't even think about it."
"Me?"
Since the chapter house was watched at all times by the agents of the primate Aeneas, Vanyon came up with a suggestion that was part subterfuge and part utilitarian. "I need to transfer some things to the inn anyway," he explained. "Aeneas knows that the inn belongs to us, so we're not giving anything away. We'll hide Carlton in the wagon bed and turn this good, honest fellow into a teamster." He looked pointedly at the patch-eyed, bearded Sparhawk. "Where on earth did you find so close a match to his real hair?" he asked Sophronia curiously. She smiled. "The next time you go into the stables, don't look too closely at your horse's tail."
"My horse?"
"He was the only black horse in the stable, Vanyon, and I didn't take all that much, really."
"My horse?" he repeated, looking injured.
"We must all make sacrifices now and then," she told him. "It's a part of the Pandion oath, remember?" Chapter 5 The wagon was rickety, and the horse was spavined. Sparhawk slouched on the wagon seat with the reins held negligently in one hand, and apparently paying very little attention to the people in the street around him. The wheels wobbled and creaked as the wagon jolted over a rutted place in the stone-paved street.
"Sparhawk, do you have to hit every single bump?" Carlton's muffled voice came from under the boxes and bales loosely piled around him in the back of the wagon.
"Keep quiet," Sparhawk muttered. "Two church soldiers are coming this way." Carlton grumbled a few choice oaths, then fell silent. The church soldiers wore red livery and disdainful expressions. As they walked through the crowded streets, the workmen and blue-clad merchants stepped aside for them. Sparhawk reined in his nag, stopping the wagon in the exact center of the street so that the soldiers would be forced to go around him.
"Morning, neighbors," he greeted them.
They glared at him, then walked on around the wagon.
"Have a pleasant day," he called after them.
They ignored him.
"What was that all about?" Carlton demanded in a low voice from the wagon bed.
"Just checking my disguise," Sparhawk replied, shaking the reins.
"Well?"
"Well, what?"
"Does it work?"
They didn't give me a second glance.
"How much farther to the inn? I'm suffocating under all this."
"Not too much farther. Give me a big surprise, Sparhawk. Miss a bump or two, just for the sake of variety." The wagon creaked on. At the barred gate of the inn, Sparhawk climbed down from the wagon and pounded the rhythmic signal on its stout timbers. After a moment, the night porter opened the gate. He looked at Sparhawk carefully.
"Sorry, friend," he said. "The inn's all full."
"We won't be staying, Sir Knight," Sparhawk told him. "We just brought a load of supplies from the chapter house." The porter's eyes widened, and he peered more closely at the big man.
"Is that you, Sir Sparhawk?"
he asked incredulously.
"I didn't even recognize you."
"That was sort of the idea. You aren't supposed to." The knight pushed the gate open, and Sparhawk led the weary horse into the courtyard.
"You can get out now," he said to Carlton as the porter closed the gate. Help get all this off me. Sparhawk moved a few of the boxes, and Colton came squirming out. The night porter gave the big blonde man an amused look.
Go ahead and say it, Colton said in a belligerent tone.
I wouldn't dream of it, Sir Knight.
Sparhawk took a long rectangular box out of the wagon bed and hoisted it up onto his shoulder.
Get somebody to help you with these supplies, he told the porter. Preceptor Vanion sent them. And take care of the horse. He's tired.
Tired? Dead would be closer.
The porter eyed the disconsolate-looking nag.
He's old, that's all. It happens to all of us sooner or later.
Is the back door to the tavern open? He looked across the courtyard at a deeply inset doorway.
It's always open, Sir Sparhawk.
Sparhawk nodded, and he and Colton crossed the courtyard.
What have you got in the box? Colton asked.
Our swords.
That's clever, but won't they be a little hard to draw?
Not after I throw the box down on the cobblestones, they won't. He opened the inset door.
After you, my lord, he said, bowing.
They passed through a cluttered storeroom and came out into a shabby-looking tavern. A century or so of dust clouded the single window, and the straw on the floor was moldy. The room smelled of stale beer and spilled wine and vomit. The low ceiling was draped with cobwebs, and the rough tables and benches were battered and tired-looking. There were only three people in the place, a sour-looking tavern keeper, a drunken man with his head cradled in his arms on a table by the door, and a blousy-looking whore in a red dress dozing in the corner. Colton went to the door and looked out into the street. It's still a little underpopulated out there, he grunted. Let's have a tankard or two while we wait for the neighborhood to wake up. Why not have some breakfast instead?
That's what I just said.
They sat at one of the tables, and the tavern keeper came over, giving no hint that he recognized them as Pandions. He made an ineffective swipe at a puddle of spilled beer on the table with a filthy rag.
What would you like?
His voice had a sullen, unfriendly tone.
Beer, Colton replied.
Bring us a little bread and cheese, too, Sparhawk added. The tavern keeper grunted and left them.
Where was Kroger when you saw him? Colton asked quietly.
In that square near the west gate.
That's a shabby part of town.
Kroger's a shabby sort of person. We could start there, I suppose, but this might take a while.
Kroger could be down just about any rat hole in Cimera.
Did you have anything else more pressing to do?
The whore in the red dress hauled herself wearily to her feet and shuffled across the straw-covered floor to their table.
I don't suppose either of you fine gentlemen would care for a bit of a frolic, she asked in a bored-sounding voice.
One of her front teeth was missing, and her red dress was cut very low in front. Perfunctorily, she leaned forward to offer them a view of her flabby-looking breasts.
It's a bit early, little sister, Sparhawk said.
Thanks all the same.
How's business? Colton asked her.
Slow. It's always slow in the morning, she sighed.
I don't suppose you could see your way clear to offer a girl something to drink, she asked hopefully.
Why not? Colton replied.
Tavern keeper, he called. Bring the lady one, too.
Thanks, my lord, the whore said. She looked around the tavern.
This is a sorry place, she said with a certain amount of resignation in her voice. I wouldn't even come in here, except that I don't like to work the streets.
She sighed.
You know something, she said. My feet hurt. Isn't that a strange thing to happen to someone in my profession? You'd think it would be my back.
Thanks again, my lord. She turned and shuffled back to the table where she had been sitting.
I like talking with whores, Colton said. They've got a nice, uncomplicated view of life.
That's a strange hobby for a church knight.
God hired me as a fighting man, Sparhawk, not as a monk. I fight whenever he tells me to, but the rest of my time is my own.
The tavern keeper brought them tankards of beer and a plate with bread and cheese on it. They sat eating and talking quietly. After about an hour, the tavern had attracted several more customers. Sweat-smelling workmen who had slipped away from their chores, and a few of the keepers of nearby shops. Sparhawk rose, went to the door, and looked out. Although the narrow back street was not exactly teeming with traffic, there were enough people moving back and forth to provide some measure of concealment. Sparhawk returned to the table.
I think it's time to be on our way, my lord,
he said to Calton. He picked up his box.
Right, Calton replied. He drained his tankard and rose to his feet, swaying slightly and with his hat on the back of his head. He stumbled a few times on the way to the door, and he was reeling just a bit as he led the way out into the street. Sparhawk followed him with the box once again on his shoulder.
"Aren't you overdoing that just a little?" he muttered to his friend when they turned the corner.
"I'm just a typical drunken courtier, Sparhawk. We just came out of a tavern."
"We're well past it now. If you act too drunk, you'll attract attention. I think it's time for a miraculous recovery." "You're taking all the fun out of this, Sparhawk," Calton complained. He stopped staggering and straightened his white-plumed hat. They moved on through the busy streets, with Sparhawk trailing respectfully behind his friend as a good squire would. When they reached another intersection, Sparhawk felt a familiar prickling of his skin. He set down his wooden box and wiped at his brow with the sleeve of his smock.
"What's the matter?" Calton asked, also stopping.
"The case is heavy, my lord," Sparhawk explained in a voice loud enough to be heard by passers-by. Then he spoke in a half-whisper.
"We're being watched," he said, as his eyes swept the sides of the street.
The robed and hooded figure was in a second-floor window, partially concealed behind a thick green drape. It looked very much like the one that had watched him in the rain-wet streets the night he had first arrived back in Simmera.
"Have you located him?" Calton asked quietly, making some show of adjusting the collar of his pink cloak.
Sparhawk grunted, raising the box to his shoulder again.
"Second-floor window. Over the chandler's shop."
"Let's be off, then, my man," Calton said in a louder voice. "The day's wearing on." As he started on up the street, he cast a quick, furtive glance at the green-draped window. They rounded another corner. "Odd-looking sort, wasn't he?" Calton noted. "Most people don't wear hoods when they're indoors. Maybe he's got something to hide. Do you think he recognized us?"
"It's hard to say. I'm not positive, but I think he was the same one who was watching me the night I came into town. I didn't get a good look at him, but I could feel him. And this one feels just about the same."
"Would magic penetrate these disguises?"
"Easily. Magic sees the man, not the clothes. Let's go down a few alleys and see if we can shake him off in case he decides to follow us."
"Right." It was nearly noon when they reached the square near the west gate where Sparhawk had seen Kroger. They split up there. Sparhawk went in one direction and called in the other. They questioned the keepers of the brightly colored booths and the more sedate shops closely, describing Kroger in some detail. On the far side of the square, Sparhawk rejoined his friend.
"Any luck?" he asked.
Calton nodded. "There's a wine merchant over there who says that a man who looks like Kroger comes in 3 or 4 times a day to buy a flagon of Arshan Red."
"That's Kroger's drink, all right," Sparhawk grinned. "If Martell finds out that he's drinking again, he'll reach down his throat and pull his heart out."
"Can you actually do that to a man?"
"You can if your arm's long enough and if you know what you're looking for."
"Did your wine merchant give you any sort of hint about which way Kroger usually comes from?"
Calton nodded.
"That street there," he pointed. Sparhawk scratched at his horsetail beard, thinking. "If you pull that loose, Sophrania's going to turn you over her knee and paddle you."
Sparhawk took his hand away from his face.
"Has Kroger picked up his first flagon of wine this morning?" he asked.
Calton nodded.
"About 2 hours ago."
"He's likely to finish that first one fairly fast. If he's drinking the way he used to, he'll wake up in the mornings feeling a bit unwell."
Sparhawk looked around the busy square.
"Let's go on up that street a ways, where there aren't quite so many people, and wait for him. As soon as he runs out of wine, he'll come out for more."
"Won't he see us? He knows us both, you know."
Sparhawk shook his head. "He's so short-sighted that he can barely see past the end of his nose. Add a flagon of wine to that, and he wouldn't be able to recognize his own mother."
"Kroger's got a mother?" Calton asked in mock amazement. "I thought he just crawled out from under a rotten log."
Sparhawk laughed.
"Let's go find some place where we can wait for him."
"Can we skulk?" Calton asked eagerly. "I haven't skulked in years."
"Skulk away, my friend," Sparhawk said. They walked up the street the wine merchant had indicated. After a few hundred paces, Sparhawk pointed toward the narrow opening of an alley.
"That ought to do it," he said.
Let's go do our skulking in there. When Kroger goes by, we can drag him into the alley and have our little chat in private.
Right, Carlton agreed with an evil grin.
They crossed the street and entered the alley. Rotting garbage lay heaped along the sides, and some way farther on was a reeking public urinal. Carlton waved one hand in front of his face.
Sometimes your decisions leave a lot to be desired, Sparhawk, he said. Couldn't you have picked someplace a little less fragrant?
You know, Sparhawk said, that's what I've missed about not having you around, Carlton. That steady stream of complaints.
Carlton shrugged. A man needs something to talk about.
He reached under his azure doublet, took out a small curved knife, and began to strop it on the sole of his boot.
I get him first, he said.
What?
Kroger. I get to start on him first.
What gave you that idea?
You're my friend, Sparhawk. Friends always let their friends go first.
Doesn't that work the other way around, too?
Carlton shook his head. You like me better than I like you. It's only natural, of course. I'm a lot more likable than you are.
Sparhawk gave him a long look.
That's what friends are for, Sparhawk, Carlton said ingratiatingly. To point out our little shortcomings to us.
They waited, watching the street from the mouth of the alley. It was not a particularly busy street, for there were but few shops along its sides. It seemed rather to be given over largely to storehouses and private dwellings. An hour dragged by, and then another.
Maybe he drank himself to sleep, Carlton said.
Not Kroger. He can hold more than a regiment. He'll be along. Carlton thrust his head out of the opening of the alleyway and squinted at the sky.
It's going to rain, he predicted.
We've both been rained on before. Carlton plucked at the front of his gaudy doublet and rolled his eyes.
But Sparhawk, he lisped outrageously. You know how satin spots when it gets wet.
Sparhawk doubled over with laughter, trying to muffle the sound. They waited once more, and another hour dragged by.
The sun's going to go down before long, Carlton said. Maybe he found another wine shop.
Let's wait a little longer, Sparhawk replied.
The rush came without warning. 8 or 10 burly fellows in rough clothing came charging down the alley with swords in their hands. Carlton's rapier came whistling out of its sheath, even as Sparhawk's hand flashed to the hilt of his short sword. The man leading the charge doubled over and gasped as Carlton smoothly ran him through. Sparhawk stepped past his friend as the blonde man recovered from his lunge. He parried the sword stroke of one of the attackers and then buried his sword in the man's belly. He wrenched the blade as he jerked it out to make the wound as big as possible.
Get that box open, he shouted at Carlton as he parried another stroke.
The alleyway was too narrow for more than two of them to come at him at once. Even though his sword was not as long as theirs, he was able to hold them at bay. Behind him he heard the splintering of wood as Carlton kicked the rectangular box apart. Then his friend was at his shoulder with his broadsword in his hand.
I've got it now, Carlton said. Get your sword.
Sparhawk spun and ran back to the mouth of the alley. He discarded the short sword, jerked his own weapon out of the wreckage of the box, and whirled back again. Carlton had cut down two of the attackers, and he was beating the others back step by step. He did, however, have his left hand pressed tightly to his side, and there was blood coming out from between his fingers. Sparhawk rushed past him, swinging his heavy sword with both hands. He split one fellow's head open and cut the sword arm off another. Then he drove the point of his sword deep into the body of yet a third, sending him reeling against the wall with a fountain of blood gushing from his mouth. The rest of the attackers fled. Sparhawk turned and saw Carlton coolly pulling his sword out of the chest of the man with the missing arm.
Don't leave them behind you like that, Sparhawk, the blonde man said. Even a one-armed man can stab you in the back. Besides, it isn't tidy. Always finish one job before you go on to the next.
He still had his left hand tightly pressed to his side.
Are you all right? Sparhawk asked him.
It's only a scratch.
Scratches don't bleed like that. Let me have a look.
The gash in Carlton's side was sizable, but it did not appear to be too deep. Sparhawk ripped the sleeve off the smock of one of the casualties, wadded it up, and placed it over the cut in Carlton's side.
Hold that in place, he said.
Push in on it to slow the bleeding.
I've been cut before, Sparhawk. I know what to do.
Sparhawk looked around at the crumpled bodies littering the alley.
I think we ought to leave, he said. Somebody in the neighborhood might get curious about all the noise.
Then he frowned.
Did you notice anything peculiar about these men? He asked. Colton shrugged. They were fairly inept. That's not what I mean. Men who make a living by waylaying people in alleys aren't usually very interested in their personal appearance, and these fellows are all clean-shaven. He rolled one of the bodies over and ripped open the front of his canvas smock. Isn't that interesting? He observed. Beneath the smock, the dead man wore a red tunic with an embroidered emblem over the left breast. Church soldier, Colton grunted. Do you think that Annius might possibly dislike us? It's not unlikely. Let's get out of here. The survivors might have gone for help. The chapter house, then? Or the inn? Sparhawk shook his head. Somebody's seen through our disguises, and Annius would expect us to go to one of those places.
You could be right about that. Any ideas?
I know of a place. It's not too far.
Are you all right to walk?
I can go as far as you can. I'm younger, remember?
Only by 6 weeks.
Younger is younger, Sparhawk. Let's not quibble about numbers. They tucked their broadswords under their belts and walked out of the mouth of the alley. Sparhawk supported his wounded friend as they moved out into the open. The street along which they walked grew progressively shabbier, and they soon entered a maze of interconnecting lanes and unpaved alleys. The buildings were large and run down, and they teemed with roughly dressed people who seemed indifferent to the squalor around them.
It's a rabbit warren, isn't it? Colton said. Is this place much farther? I'm getting a little tired.
It's just on the other side of that next intersection.
Colton grunted and pressed his hand more tightly to his side. They moved on. The looks directed at them by the inhabitants of this slum were unfriendly, even hostile. Colton's clothing marked him as a member of the ruling class, and these people at the very bottom of society had little use for courtiers and their servants. When they reached the intersection, Sparhawk led his friend up a muddy alley. They had gone about halfway when a thick-bodied man with a rusty pike in his hand stepped out of a doorway to bar their path.
"Where do you think you're going?" he demanded.
"I need to talk to Platamy," Sparhawk replied.
"I don't think he wants to hear anything you have to say. If you're smart, you'll get out of this part of town before nightfall. Accidents happen here after dark.
And sometimes even before dark," Sparhawk said, drawing his sword.
"I can have a dozen men here in 2 winks.
And my broken-nosed friend here can have your head off in one," Colton told him. The man stepped back, his face apprehensive.
"What's it to be, neighbor?" Sparhawk asked. "Do you take us to Platamy, or do you and I play for a bit?"
"You've got no right to threaten me."
Sparhawk raised his sword so that the fellow could get a good look at it.
"This gives me all sorts of rights, neighbor. Lean your pike against that wall and take us to Platamy. Now!"
The thick-bodied man flinched and then carefully set his pike against the wall, turned, and led them on up the alley. It came to a dead end 100 paces farther on, and a stone stairway ran down to what appeared to be a cellar door.
"Down there," the man said, pointing.
"Lead the way," Sparhawk told him. "I don't want you behind me, friend. You look like the sort who might make errors in judgment." Sullenly, the fellow went down the mud-coated stairs and rapped twice on the door.
"It's me," he called. "Seth. There are a couple of nobles here who want to talk to Platamy."
There was a pause followed by the rattling of a chain. The door opened, and a bearded man thrust his head out.
"Platamy doesn't like noblemen," he declared.
"I'll change his mind for him," Sparhawk said. "Step back out of the way, neighbor." The bearded man looked at the sword in Sparhawk's hand, swallowed hard, and opened the door wider.
"Press right along, Seth," Colton said to their guide.
Seth went through the door. "Join us, friend," Sparhawk told the bearded man when he and Colton were inside. "We like lots of company." The stairs continued down between moldy stone walls that wept moisture. At the bottom, the stair opened out into a very large cellar with a vaulted stone ceiling. There was a fire burning in a pit in the center of the room, filling the air with smoke, and the walls were lined with roughly constructed cots and straw-filled pallets. 2 dozen or so men and women in a wide variety of garments sat on those cots and pallets drinking and playing at dice. Just beyond the fire pit,
A huge man with a fierce black beard and a vast paunch sprawled in a large chair with his feet thrust out toward the flames. He wore a satin doublet of a faded orange color, spotted and stained down the front, and he held a silver tankard in one beefy hand.
"That's Platymy," Seth said nervously. "He's a little drunk, so you should be careful, my lords."
"We can deal with it," Sparhawk told him. "Thanks for your help, Seth. I don't know how we'd have managed without you." Then he led Calton on around the fire pit. "Who are all these people?" Calton asked in a low voice, looking around at the men and women lining the walls. "Thieves, beggars, a few murderers probably, that sort of thing." "You've got some very nice friends, Sparhawk." Platymy was carefully examining a necklace with a ruby pendant attached to it. When Sparhawk and Calton stopped in front of him, he raised his bleary eyes and looked them over, paying particular attention to Calton's finery.
"Who let these two in here?" he roared.
"We sort of let ourselves in, Platymy," Sparhawk told him, thrusting his sword back under his belt and turning up his eye patch so that it no longer impaired his vision.
"Well, you can sort of let yourselves back out again."
"That wouldn't be convenient right now, I'm afraid," Sparhawk told him. The gross man in the orange doublet snapped his fingers, and the people lining the walls stood up.
"You're badly outnumbered, my friend."
Platymy looked around suggestively at his cohorts.
"That's been happening fairly often lately," Calton said with his hand on the hilt of his broadsword.
Platymy's eyes narrowed.
"Your clothes and that sword don't exactly match," he said.
"And I try so hard to coordinate my attire," Calton sighed.
"Just who are you two?" Platymy asked suspiciously. "This one is dressed like a courtier, but I don't think he's really one of those walking butterflies from the palace."
"He sees right to the core of things, doesn't he?" Calton said to Sparhawk. He looked at Platymy. "Actually, we're Pandions," he said.
"Church knights? I thought it might be something like that. Why the fancy clothes, then?"
"We're both fairly well known," Sparhawk told him. "We wanted to be able to move around without being recognized." Platymy looked meaningfully at Calton's bloodstained doublet.
"It looks to me as if somebody saw through your disguises," he said. "Or maybe you just frequent the wrong taverns. Who stabbed you?"
"A church soldier," Calton shrugged. "He got in a lucky thrust. Do you mind if I sit down? I'm feeling a little shaky for some reason."
"Somebody bring him a stool," Platymy shouted.
Then he looked back at the two of them.
"Why would church knights and church soldiers be fighting?" he asked.
"Palace politics," Sparhawk shrugged. "They get a little murky sometimes."
"That's God's own truth. What's your business here?"
"We need a place to stay for a while," Sparhawk told him. He looked around. "This cellar of yours ought to work out fairly well."
"Sorry, friend. I can sympathize with a man who's just had a run-in with the church soldiers, but I'm conducting a business here. There's no room for outsiders."
Platymy looked at Calton, who had just sunk down on a stool that a ragged beggar had brought him.
"Did you kill the man who stabbed you?"
"He did," Calton pointed at Sparhawk. "I killed a few others, but my friend here did most of the fighting."
"Why don't we get down to business?" Sparhawk said.
"I think you owe my family a debt, Platymy."
"I don't have any dealings with nobles," Platymy replied, "except to cut a few of their throats from time to time, so it's unlikely that I owe your family a thing.
This debt has nothing to do with money. A long time ago, some church soldiers were hanging you. My father stopped them." Platymy blinked.
"You're Sparhawk?" he said in surprise.
"You don't look that much like your father." "It's his nose," Calton said. "When you break a man's nose, you change his whole appearance. Why were the soldiers hanging you?"
"It was all a misunderstanding. I knifed a fellow. He wasn't wearing his uniform, so I didn't know he was an officer in the Primate's Guard."
He looked disgusted.
"And all he had in his purse were 2 silver coins and a handful of copper."
"Do you acknowledge the debt?" Sparhawk pressed. Platymy pulled at his coarse black beard.
"I guess I do," he admitted.
"We'll stay here, then.
That's all you want?"
"Not quite. We're looking for a man.
A fellow named Kroger. Your beggars are all over town, and I want them to look for him.
Fair enough. Can you describe him?
I can do better than that. I can show him to you.
That doesn't exactly make sense, friend.
It will in a minute. Have you got a basin of some kind, and some clean water?
I think I can manage that.
What have you got in mind? He's going to make an image of Kroger's face in the water, Colton said. It's an old trick. Platamy looked impressed.
I've heard that you Pandions are all wizards, but I've never seen anything like that before.
Sparhawk's better at it than I am, Colton admitted. One of the beggars furnished a chipped basin filled with slightly cloudy water. Sparhawk set the basin on the floor and concentrated for a moment, muttering the styric words of the spell under his breath. Then he passed his hand slowly over the basin, and Kroger's puffy-looking face appeared.
Now that is really something to see, Platamy marveled.
It's not too difficult, Sparhawk said modestly. Have your people here look at it. I can't keep it there forever.
How long can you hold it?
10 minutes or so. It starts to break up after that.
Talon, the fat man shouted. Come here.
A grubby-looking boy of about 10 slouched across the room. His tunic was ragged and dirty, but he wore a long red satin vest that had been fashioned by cutting the sleeves off a doublet. There were several knife holes in the vest.
What do you want? He asked insolently. Can you copy that?
Platamy asked, pointing at the basin.
Of course I can, but why should I? Because I'll box your ears if you don't.
Talon grinned at him.
You'd have to catch me first, fat man, and I can run faster than you can.
Sparhawk dug a finger into a pocket of his leather jerkin and took out a small silver coin. Would this make it worth your while? He asked, holding up the coin. Talon's eyes brightened.
For that, I'll give you a masterpiece, he promised.
All we want is accuracy.
Whatever you say, my patron, Talon bowed mockingly. I'll go get my things.
Is he really any good? Colton asked Platamy after the boy had scurried over to one of the cots lining the wall. Platamy shrugged.
I'm not an art critic, he said. He spends all his time drawing pictures, though, when he isn't begging or stealing.
Isn't he a little young for your line of work?
Platamy laughed. He's got the nimblest fingers in Cimera, he said. He could steal your eyes right out of their sockets, and you wouldn't even miss them until you went to look closely at something.
I'll keep that in mind, Colton said.
It could be too late, my friend. Weren't you wearing a ring when you came in?
Colton blinked, then raised his blood-stained left hand and stared at it. There was no ring on the hand. Chapter 6 Colton winced.
Easy, Sparhawk, he said. That really hurts.
It has to be cleaned before I can bandage it, Sparhawk replied, continuing to wipe the cut on his friend's side with a wine-soaked cloth.
But do you have to do it so hard?
Platamy waddled around the smoky fire pit and stood over the cot where Colton lay.
Is he going to be all right? He asked.
Probably, Sparhawk replied. He's had the blood let out of him a few times before, and he usually recovers. He laid aside the cloth and picked up a long strip of linen.
Sit up, he told his friend.
Colton grunted and pushed himself into a sitting position. Sparhawk began to wind the strip about his waist.
Not so tight, Colton said. I have to be able to breathe.
Quit complaining.
Were those church soldiers after you for any particular reason?
Platamy asked.
Or were they just amusing themselves?
They had reasons, Sparhawk told him as he knotted Colton's bandage. We've managed to be fairly offensive to Primate Annius lately.
Good for you. I don't know how you noblemen feel about him, but the common people all hate him.
We moderately despise him.
That's one thing we all have in common, then. Is there any chance that Queen Alana might recover?
We're working on that. Platamy sighed.
I think she's our only hope, Sparhawk. Otherwise Annius is going to run Elania to suit himself, and that would really be too bad.
Patriotism, Platamy? Colton asked.
Just because I'm a thief and a murderer doesn't mean that I'm disloyal. I respect the crown as much as any man in the kingdom. I even respected Aldreas, weak as he was.
Fatimi's eyes grew sly.
Did his sister ever really seduce him? He asked. There were all kinds of rumors.
Sparhawk shrugged.
That's sort of hard to say. She went absolutely wild after your father forced Aldreas to marry Queen Alana's mother, you know.
Fatimi sniggered.
She was totally convinced that she was going to marry her brother and get control of the throne.
Isn't that sort of illegal? Calton asked.
Anius said that he'd found a way around the law. Anyway, after Aldreas got married, Orisa ran away from the palace. They found her a few weeks later in that cheap brothel over by the river. Just about everybody in Simera had tried her before they dragged her out of the place.
He squinted at them.
What did they finally do with her, anyway? Chop off her head?
No, Sparhawk told him. She's cloistered in the nunnery at Deimos. They're very strict there.
At least she's getting some rest. From what I hear, the Princess Orisa was a very busy young woman.
He straightened and pointed at a nearby cot.
You can use that one, he told Sparhawk. I've got every thief and beggar in Simera out looking for this Krager fellow of yours. If he sets foot in the streets, we'll know about it within an hour. In the meantime, you might as well get some sleep.
Sparhawk nodded and rose to his feet.
Are you all right? He asked Calton.
I'm fine.
Do you need anything?
How about some beer? Just to restore all the blood I lost, of course.
Of course.
It was impossible to tell what time it was, since the cellar had no windows. Sparhawk felt a light touch and came awake immediately, catching the hand that had touched him. The grubby-looking boy Talon made a sour face.
Never try to pick a pocket when you're shivering, he said.
He mopped the rain out of his face.
It's really a miserable morning out there,
he added. Were you looking for anything in particular in my pockets?
No, not really. Just anything that might turn up.
Would you like to give me back my friend's ring?
Oh, I suppose so.
I only took it to keep in practice, anyway. Talon reached inside his wet tunic and drew out Colton's ring.
I cleaned the blood off it for him, he said, admiring it.
He'll appreciate that.
Oh, by the way, I found that fellow you were looking for.
Krager? Where?
He's staying in a brothel in Lion Street.
A brothel?
Maybe he needs affection.
Sparhawk sat up. He touched his horsehair beard to make sure it was still in place.
Let's go talk to Platini.
Do you want me to wake your friend?
Let him sleep. I'm not going to take him out in the rain in his condition anyway.
Platini was snoring in his chair, but his eyes opened instantly when Talon touched his shoulder.
The boy found Krager, Sparhawk told him. You're going after him, I suppose?
Sparhawk nodded.
Do you think the primate soldiers are still looking for you?
Probably.
And they know what you look like?
Yes.
You won't get very far, then.
I'll have to chance it.
Platini, Talon said.
What?
Do you remember that time when we had to get Weasel out of town in a hurry?
Platini grunted, scratching at his paunch and looking speculatively at Sparhawk.
How much are you attached to that beard? He asked.
Not too much. Why?
If you'd be willing to shave it off, I know a way you might be able to move around Simera without being recognized.
Sparhawk began pulling off chunks of the false beard. Platini laughed.
You really aren't attached to it, are you?
He looked at Talon.
Go get what he'll need out of the bin.
Talon went to a large wooden box in the corner of the cellar and started rummaging around inside as Sparhawk finished removing the beard. When the boy came back, he was carrying a ragged-looking cloak and a pair of shoes that were little more than rotting leather bags.
How much of the rest of your face will come off?
Platini asked. Sparhawk took the ragged cloak from Talon and poured some of Platini's wine on one corner. Then he vigorously scrubbed his face, removing the remnants of Sophrenia's glue and the purple scar.
The nose? Platini asked.
No, that's real.
How did it get broken?
It's a long story. Platini shrugged.
Take off your boots and those leather breeches. You'll wear the cloak and those shoes.
End of side 2. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over.